In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the health of the oceans. And our guest for the program will be environmental writer David Helvarg. He's an award-winning journalist. He's been a war correspondent and also a private investigator, and has been for a long, long time interested in the subject of oceans. His reporting on the oceans goes back to the 70s, when he wrote an award-winning series of articles on the rush to develop deep sea mining. Since then, he's written many articles. He's also been involved in television documentary reports on a range of ocean topics, things like offshore drilling, high seas drift nets. He's also done profiles of important figures in ocean exploration, and his articles have appeared in many different publications. Just a few, to name a few, the Smithsonian, The Nation, The New York Times, The San Francisco Examiner. He's also been on the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour, other shows on PBS, the Discovery Channel, A&E. He's the author of a recently published book that deals with this subject that's titled Blue Frontier, the subtitle Saving America's Living Seas. It's published by W.H. Freeman and Company, and is out now in bookstores if you want to take a look at it. He's also a contributing editor to NPR's radio show Marketplace, where he delivers a regular radio column on ocean economics, and is the author of an earlier book that we actually talked about on this show, a book titled The War Against the Greens, which was published in 1994. It's kind of hard to believe it's been that long, but indeed, that's the case. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. So as we talk, your questions are welcome. All we ask from listeners is people just try to be brief so we can keep things moving along, but anyone's welcome to call. For the folks here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, any place that signal will travel, 800-222-9455. Mr. Helvarg, hello.
David, hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, it's good to be back on your show.
We appreciate it. The I think the title of the book, you're intending that people think about the oceans in a couple of ways. One, that it is indeed this planet's great unexplored frontier. But also, I think that you're encouraging people to think about the way in which we explored and exploited our own frontier in this country. And it's an opportunity, you suggest, for us to do things a little bit differently this time around.
Yeah, and it quite literally is a frontier as well. From an American perspective, in 1890, the Census Bureau declared our frontier closed. But in 1983, Ronald Reagan, in one of the least noted acts of his administration, declared an exclusive economic zone for 200 miles out from our coastlines. And in effect gave us a new frontier that's 3.4 million square nautical miles. It's about six times the size of the Louisiana Purchase, or 30% larger than our continental landmass. And so I do draw the analogy. I think it's accurate that that we have a second opportunity here to avoid some of the mistakes we made on our last frontier. And the parallels are pretty strong. If you look at what we did with wildlife on the former frontier, for example, we were shooting buffalo for about 100 years, but just between 1860 and 1880, you had this coming together of technology and the market of the Sharps repeating rifle and the railheads that allowed the skins to be taken back to eastern markets. And within that 20-year period, pretty much decimated, wiped out the buffalo populations. Today, we have a global fish market and technology like sonar and satellite tracking that's inherited from the Navy, from the military, an overcapitalized fleet that has a market somewhere in the world for everything, what we used to call junk fish, sea urchins, horseshoe crabs, skates, now have markets, whether it's in Japan or Hong Kong. And we're literally, we've got more net in the water than the fish are able to compensate for through reproduction. So that we're seeing a number of parallels where the railroads were given western lands for pennies per acre by their friends in Congress. You see a similar rush to develop offshore resources with the leasing of oil and gas permits in the Gulf of Mexico and the Department of Interior now wanting to reopen some of the moratoriums, some of the closed areas off California, Oregon, Washington, Florida, North Carolina. A real, you know, frontier boomtown mentality that unfortunately can't be sustained by the limits of the natural resources we have there. And also it's an approach we don't really need to take, that there's a lot of ways to do sustainable harvesting of the seas. There's a lot of ways to reduce the polluted runoff so that we have clean waters and opportunities for recreation. I mean, going to the beach is, you know, the number one recreational activity Americans pursue in terms of outdoor activities. And it's, you know, it's a lot cheaper and more fun to go to the thrill ride of ocean waves at the beach for a weekend than to, you know, have to shell out $150 to take the kids to some local amusement park. We love the ocean. It's unfortunately, we love it, but we don't fully understand it. And we're moving to it in record numbers. 17 of the 20 fastest growing counties in America are coastal. But we've got a lot to understand. We get so much out of the oceans and don't return a lot. I mean, the oceans are literally the lungs of the world. 70% of the oxygen we breathe comes out of the oceans. They're the drivers of weather and climate and plankton. You know, we think of the rainforest absorbing carbon dioxide. Plankton absorbs most of it. It's 71% of our planet, and we know less about it than we know about some of the other, you know, the moon and some of the other planets in this solar system. We've certainly mapped far less of the ocean than we have the moon.
Well, that you one of the things that you write about in the book is having had the opportunity to spend some time with people who are involved in ocean exploration, particularly deep, as deep as it's possible for us to go. How much do we know? How much exploring have we really done?
It's very much that new frontier analogy. In September, I'll be going out with a cruise from Woods Hole in Massachusetts that will be exploring deep canyons off of George's Bank and the Hudson Canyons, 20 miles outside New York Harbor. And these are areas with benthic deep-sea bottom life that's not fully identified. They expect to find new life forms to discover geological patterns and impacts that haven't been fully understood. It's fairly amazing. Until just over 20 years ago, in the late 70s, we thought that all life was photosynthetic. Everything got its energy from the sun. And then a deep diving vessel off the Galapagos discovered chemosynthetic life, that these hot springs, these geothermal springs, volcanic-powered springs bubbling up with sulfur dioxide, and that there were all these life forms around it, clams and crabs and sea worms, feathery sea worms, that contained a microbe that could convert what would be to us poisonous sulfur dioxide into energy and live off of it. And today NASA thinks that if there's other life in our solar system, it would probably be this kind of chemosynthetic life that might live in the deep oceans under the ice of the Jupiter moon Europa. So the discoveries are amazing. We're discovering in Monterey Canyon, where I'm going to be next week, they're still discovering about a new species of life every week. Only a few years ago did they realize that that not only was the bottom alive, but that most of the biomass in the water was jellies. You know, in the past, you need to go down there with robot subs or with mad submersibles to see this, because in the past you just pull up dredges and nets and it would just look like slime. Mm. And when you get down there, you see that it's incredible variety of life forms. 80% of all life is thought to be in the sea, and certainly it makes sense because 95% of the habitat is there. It's sustainable life in three dimensions.
Well, it's another interesting way that the way that things work in the ocean maybe parallels our interest in tropical forest, because as you said, one statistic that if we're concerned about carbon dioxide, the ocean has a much greater role in soaking that up than forest. But also when it comes to forest, one of the things we're interested in, and rightly so, is the issue of preserving biodiversity, because we think that there may be many plant animal species that are living there that haven't even been identified yet, or perhaps haven't been named. That is true, but even to a greater degree in the oceans, we expect that there's all sorts of living things there that have not been identified.
And exactly. And scientists are guessing that extinction rates may be going five times as fast in the marine environment as in the terrestrial, simply because it's a kind of out of sight, out of mind attitude. And we have tremendous exploitation of the living resources through fisheries, and at the same time that 70% of the world's fisheries are overfished, overexploited, according to the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, the possibility for regenerating those resources is diminished because of coastal pollution, because of the loss of estuaries and coastal wetlands that acts as the nurseries for a wide variety of species. We're also fertilizing the sea in very counterproductive ways. Literally, all the excess fertilizer and farm chemicals that run off our fields into our watersheds, rivers down the Mississippi and other water systems. These excess nutrients feed algae blooms, and these algae blooms create dead zones, annual dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, 7,000 square miles plus, about the size of New Jersey. And with this spring's flooding in Mississippi, you can expect a larger-than-usual dead zone where the nutrients feed great algae blooms, and then as the algae decays, they're fed on by copepods, little pin-sized critters, and as they sink in the water column, microbes feed on them, and in the process of this decaying, suck all the dissolved oxygen out of the water, kills everything that can't swim away, all the bottom life and what swims away, like the shrimp. You literally now have shrimpers lining up on the edge of the dead zone to catch the shrimp who are fleeing, out of the dead zone and into the nets. But the shrimpers are worried too. Everybody is, because if it continues to grow, there's no place left in the water column with enough oxygen to survive. And so, we're pounding down. We always thought of the oceans as a kind of limitless bounty. But as we look historically at the history of America and the sea, we see that we've lost historic levels of bounty, that in the past, the new collapse of the cod fishery in New England, for example, the George's Bank was the greatest fishery in human history, and you have historic writings where the colonists talk of lowering baskets with rocks into the water in parts of the banks there, and literally, pulling up baskets full of fish. Former governor of New Amsterdam, New York, now talked of 6-foot lobsters in the waters on the Hudson River, and the Chesapeake Bay was someplace navigators were afraid to enter for fear of wrecking their ships on the great oyster reefs that were there. Even places we still enjoy going, like the Florida Keys, are being impacted by this polluted runoff, by nutrient runoff from the sugar fields of South Florida, from the developed urban runoff of the cities, from local development and digging of sewage systems that are ineffective, and also from global warming, which has impacted reefs globally in terms of bleaching. As water warms up, they lose some of their algaes, which give them the color. And if they lose these algaes for too long, they can literally starve the living coral. So I was visiting an underwater habitat in the Florida Keys called Aquarius, where scientists spend 6 to 10 days at a time studying the state of the reef. And Steve Miller, who's the chief scientist working down there for the National Underseas Research Consortium, was saying, we used to talk about think globally and act locally. He says it doesn't work anymore because the impacts they're seeing on the reef, they're local, they're regional, and they're global. And we have to think and act simultaneously at all these levels if we're going to help turn things around.
Here, I probably should introduce our guest once again for anybody who might have tuned in the last little bit here. We're talking with environmental writer David Helvarg, and he is the author of a recently published book that's titled Blue Frontier, Saving America's Living Seas. It's published by W.H. Freeman and Company, and explores a number of topics that have to do with the health of the oceans. Questions are welcome here, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. One of the things that you write about in the book is the way in which the military, the U.S. military, particularly the Navy, has set the course of ocean research. And you write in the book that, in fact, until recently, few scientists in this country, marine scientists, took a leadership role in alerting the public to the environmental dangers facing the oceans, particularly the areas around the country. And you say that it has little to do with lack of insight on their part, but it has much more to do with the hidden history of U.S. oceanography. And that definitely connects to the military and to defense concerns. Okay, maybe you could talk a little bit about the way in which that has shaped the kind of research that's been done.
Sure. Up until World War II, oceanography, as it was developing this country, was kind of a boathouse-based project that looked at the near-shore systems, a lot of times out of necessity, lacking the blue water vessels. But you had people like Bill Ritter, the first director of Scripps, and Ed Ricketts, who was a biologist up in Monterey and a good friend of John Steinbeck's. And they introduced concepts like ecology. They studied the interrelationships of living things, of plants and animals in our productive nearshore environment. And then World War II broke out. And in fact, in my chapter, Oceanographers and Admirals, I open up with a lot of first-person descriptions, veterans of Pearl Harbor who I interviewed, talking about the attack, because it really not only brought the U.S. into World War II, but it changed oceanography profoundly. And until World War II, it was about biology and marine biology primarily. And then with the beginning of the war, the scientists went to work for the Navy, and the needs were really the needs for physical oceanography, for people to develop sonar to predict the tidal changes and coastal conditions for amphibious landings. And they developed a war research center at the University of California. Roger Revelle's kind of one of the major figures in U.S. oceanographic history in the second half of this century. I interviewed Roger before he died several years ago. And he organized the physical oceanographers to help win the war, as I say, through very practical things like developing underwater explosives, sonar to track enemy submarines and the like. But with the closing of the war, the Navy felt it had a good thing here and essentially decided to hang on to the scientists and the science. They set up the Office of Naval Research and through ONR expanded the funding for institutes like Scripps and Woods Hole, and also really created a whole network, kind of seeded the coast with institutes, Oregon State and Washington, University of Washington, Miami University, and Texas A&M were all given incredible amounts of Navy money and funding to expand their research into the blue waters, into the deep waters. But it was a bit of a Mephistian deal. The deal was that all the World War II scientists became the heads of these institutes, and the physical oceanographers really took over. The biologists became second-class citizens, in a sense. And the research was all oriented really towards the Navy's needs, which was physical oceanography, understanding deep water environments to improve the Navy's ability to track Soviet submarines. It was a meeting of civilian oceanographers at Woods Hole in 1956 that really got the Navy. The Navy and the Army were very scared at the beginning of the Cold War. They faced this tremendous enemy, which, of course, was the Air Force, had the monopoly on atom bombs. But it was with civilian oceanographers who figured out how to put small payloads in solid fuel rockets with small guidance systems that they could launch from submarines, got the Navy into the nuclear weapons triad. And really for 50 years, it was acoustics and blue water science led by physical oceanographers that dominated. And unfortunately, this was the same 50-year period that we saw the collapse of our nearshore ecosystems, of our estuaries and mangrove swamps and seagrass meadows, coral reefs, and the like. And the science wasn't there. The science was following the funding, and the funding, 1.70% of Woods Hole's funding was coming from the Navy, and this was a dominant funding source throughout much of the Cold War and certainly set the standard so that the head of Scripps, for example, in the 1980s was a former Assistant Secretary General of NATO, and at the same time the head of Woods Hole was former anti-submarine warfare admiral from the Navy. And with the end of the Cold War, we're just beginning to see some of the ocean science reorganize itself back to a historic interest in the big environmental issues, which may also be the big national security issues in this century, like the role of the ocean in climate change, like how do we deal with an ecosystem in collapse where we're losing the cods and the corals and the healthy ecosystems that make the ocean what it is to us.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you touched on, and it certainly is true, and this has to do with the place where the land and the ocean meet. In relatively recently, there's been a big rush to the coastal areas of this country. People like, and for reasons we can understand, people like living near the water. However, what it also means is that people have been moving into areas that are ecologically sensitive, and also areas where the interesting thing about the coast is that it's not stable. It's always changing. However, these folks, when they move there, one thing they want is a beach, and they want sand, and they want it to stay there. They don't want it to come and go. And so there have been all kinds of things that have been done along the coastal areas to try to create, preserve, stabilize beaches for the people who live near there who want to go to the beach, except that that's really not the way those areas work. And it seems as if by intervening in those areas, in fact, we've ended up creating problems that didn't exist before.
Exactly. And as I say in the book, barrier islands are a particularly fine example of the mobility of the coastline. Barrier islands are like geology on amphetamines. I mean, in their natural state, they're constantly moving. They're called barrier islands because storms move them around and shift the sand from the ocean side to the bay side and shift the shape of these islands. And very few people, interestingly, it's the federal government seems to be the main force in encouraging this coastal real estate boom of the last 30 years or so. Because until 1968, if you wanted to risk building on the beach, literally on the beach or in harm's way, you couldn't get mortgage from the bank. You had to either be very rich and willing to lose it, or you built a beach shack that you could go surf out of, but you didn't mind losing it to the next hurricane. 1968, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, decided that it would absorb some of the costs of emergency evacuations and the like by offering flood insurance in these areas. And they thought that they could absorb some of the cost also by making the flood insurance very cheap, so they have a large insurance pool. Well, once the federal government started providing this flood insurance for people in coastal areas, the banks started providing mortgages, and lo and behold, developers could start building 14- and 15-story condominiums right on the beach, knowing that they could get the mortgages because the federal flood insurance was there. And so you saw hurricanes come in, take out beach shacks, and urban seawalls took their place. Pretty soon you have places like Ocean City, Maryland, or Biloxi, Mississippi, or Atlantic City, where Miami Beach, where the surf line literally comes up to the hotel walls. And, the federal insurance system worked for about 20 years. Unfortunately, this was the 20 years of historic lull in Atlantic hurricane activity. As soon as we got into the historically more active period beginning in the early 90s with things like Hurricane Hugo and Hurricane Andrew and Hurricane Mitch and Hurricane George, it became a loser, and it has been a loser. Right now, we've got about $500 trillion out there in insured properties by us, the taxpayers. Half that money is invested in Florida real estate insurance. So, ironically, the agency that's supposed to help in emergencies has actually helped move people in harm's way. And once people are there, it's very hard to say that, hey, maybe it's safer not to be sitting on stilts on the beach. Maybe it's safer to be back on the bluff or behind the dunes. There are a few examples. I use one in the book of Seaside, Florida. We have a few developers who've thought about what it really means to put people in harm's way. In Seaside, for example, they built in the Florida Panhandle behind the dunes, and the developer, as a child, had spent time in the beach areas, and he remembered how construction was in the old days. So he built above and beyond code. He only uses materials that were in existence in 1945 or earlier because he doesn't feel the newer stuff has been adequately tested. And when Hurricane Opal hit the Panhandle in 95, towns on either side were destroyed, and Seaside survived it very well because it was behind the dunes, because it was built well, because they'd only planted native grasses and trees that secure the dunes and the ground. And interestingly, in talking with this fellow, he said that he tries to talk about environmental development, sustainable development to other developers. He says he tries to explain that he simply believes that the principle of long-term greed is a more effective one than the principle of short-term greed. Mm. And in fact, his development, which is set away from the beach, has a higher value than the, you know, slab construction right on the beach. A similar phenomenon along the whole California coast, where because there is a high level of coastal protection under California's Coastal Commission, the property values are actually higher than where people just build right up to the edge of the sea and then wait for the next storm to come in. And the next storm is going to come in more intensely because of also because of climate change. We've seen a 1 foot level, 1 foot rise in sea level in this century. 70% of the world's beaches are now eroding. And the projections from the best available science is that we could see another 3 feet of sea level rise in the next 50 or 60 years. So it's you know, fairly insane to have our tax money going to put people in harm's way, but that's the effect right now.
We have a couple of callers here who would like to get in on the conversation. Let's start with someone in Chicago, line four.
Thank
Hello.
You.
Yes.
Most interesting. Mankind may have evolved from the sea, and certainly we have to respect the creatures that live in the sea as well. We so often think of the environment only in the terms of the land and the forest and the other aspects, but there's species in the ocean that can certainly teach us lessons for living together. Some species live harmoniously, and of course the big fish eat the little fish. I guess that's their way of expecting to survive, and we have emulated that to some extent. But I'm wondering how much mining is being considered in terms of the resources and minerals and so forth that are existing in the ocean. Is there attempts to conserve, or is this going to be a 49ers gold rush to get the minerals out of the ocean?
Well, it's interesting because really the way we got our 200-mile limit was a result of this sort of early 1970s gold rush where...
As well as oil.
The oil and the gas is very actively exploited. I visited some offshore platforms in the Gulf of Mexico, and when you're up in the helicopter there, you literally can't look around without seeing a platform. There's some 4,000 platforms out there. And interestingly, with the administration's talk of energy crisis, there's little mention of the fact that, in fact, there's an energy bonanza, a boom going on in deep water exploitation in the Gulf, where I'm right now writing a piece for Popular Science about drilling in 1,000 to 10,000-foot depths, which is going on now. It's getting tax subsidies from the government, which are unneeded. It's a real bonanza. The mineral mining was, ironically, it started out as a CIA cover story. When the Glomar Explorer went out to lift up this sunken Russian submarine, the cover story the CIA put out was it was going to start mining minerals. And since it was a Howard Hughes ship, and since the Law of the Seas Convention was meeting in Caracas, Venezuela, at the same time the ship sailed, the Third World thought it was real, thought there was $1 trillion of minerals about to be exploited, and they wanted their share of the action. It led to 10 or 15 years of conflict in the Law of the Seas, and finally, like a school of panic mullet, the Third World coastal nations started declaring their EEZs, and we followed suit. So we fenced off a third of the world's oceans kind of on the myth of mineral wealth, but from an economic point of view, it's not really viable to be dredging low-assay manganese nodules from 15 or 20,000 feet off the ocean floor and then processing them in big...
And I hope we don't make it into a big garbage dump. One other point. I understand China said in terms of fishing, they could certainly use all the fish that's existing in the ocean. That's the state of affairs where so many schools of fish are now becoming depleted. I'm wondering if we can exert some efforts to... prohibits fishing of certain species and contribute to their survival as well as ours. Thank you.
Thank you. And hopefully we will, through some of the migratory fish treaties that exist, international treaties, begin working in that direction. I mean, China also has some of the best aquaculture, which is raising carp and tilapia, you know, freshwater fish that can live off agricultural surplus, ag waste and grasses and the like. The danger is when we try and fish the top predators out of the ocean. We take out the sharks and the tuna and the salmon. That tends to collapse larger, more complex ecosystems.
You know, it's interesting. Certainly in the book, you write about aquaculture, and you've touched on it a little bit here. We actually, a couple of weeks ago, did a program talking with someone from, I think it was from the Environmental Defense Fund, who had done some writing on aquaculture that raised the point that, first of all, that probably what people don't realize is that an awful lot of the seafood that we're now eating is farm-raised one way or another, but that for those people whose concern is overfishing, this somehow gets in some respects undercut by the fact that some of these farm-raised fish are carnivorous, and to feed them, we're going out and we're rounding up everything that we can in open water. And so even though we're doing this farm-raising, that's not necessarily good for the other fish in the ocean.
Exactly. And it's almost counterintuitive. People think, well, if we're overfishing, then we should just, you know, raise fish in farms, and that's the answer. But it's certainly more complex than that. It's a new industry, and parts of it have potential, the freshwater farming of catfish and tilapia, for example, or shellfish, which, one of the few places left where I'm confident eating raw oysters is in the Tamales Bay in California, because the oyster pens are right there where you can see them, and the bay is relatively clean. Shellfish actually take nutrients out of the water, so they're helping to clean it up. But when you start raising salmon, it's like factory farming. They're concentrated. They get diseases, sea lice and the like, so they feed them antibiotics, and the waste and the antibiotics get into the water column, damage the benthic community below them. They also have regular escapes, and these, they're all Atlantic salmon. They start breeding in Pacific River waters and undermining the viability of the wild salmon. So aquaculture is definitely a mixed lot in terms of salmon, in terms of prawns, which is a big third world aquaculture. So basically agro-export. They take out their mangroves to put in prawn farms and then over-fertilize them and have to build new ponds, which takes out more mangroves. And those are not only productive areas for local fisheries, but also protective as storm barriers. So you have to look at the industry very carefully, and I really think the best we can do is protecting wild fisheries, and some of the most sustainable seafood now is things like wild salmon from Alaska. And in fact, there's a couple of programs, Legal Seafoods and other companies have begun to work with environmentalists to educate the public about what is and isn't sustainable seafood, so that maybe we can start making some educated choices when it comes to the menu. For example, maybe take squid or catfish as opposed to Atlantic swordfish or shark, something along those lines. And there are, striped bass is coming back. There are some success stories, and those are the things we have to work with and use as models.
You touched on the issue of the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, which scientists think is the result of both urban and rural runoff that eventually makes its way into the Mississippi, that then makes its way down into the Gulf. I think also in the past there has been real concern about the amount of waste produced in large cities that happen to be on the coast that gets into coastal waters. What can you say about the issue of pollution in those waters that are coastal, that are close to the coast of the country all the way around?
Well, I think that there's a good model in that with the Clean Water Act in the 1970s. Since then, a lot of point pollution sources, factory pipes and urban sewage treatment plants have been upgraded. We spent $40 billion upgrading our urban sewage system. And for example, I was just in Boston this last weekend, and several billion dollars was spent to get the pathogens and bacteria out of Boston's harbor. And as a result, you're seeing, this tremendous rediscovery of the waterfront and the bay. And Boston has its waterfront area now with the aquarium, with shops and hotels that have rediscovered the bay. The National Park Service is taking some of the harbor islands and opening up to the public as recreational areas. And this is all a product of a decade-long cleanup program that created the Deer Park sewage treatment that reduced the level of pollutions in the bay. And I think a lot of coastal towns from Portsmouth, New Hampshire to Hilo, Hawaii have rediscovered their waterfronts and invested that kind of money. The problem now is we've gone from the point pollution to this non-point, this broader problem of runoff through storm drains and agricultural lands, and we have to start thinking creatively and realizing it's worth the investment to keep our coast clean. And there are also models of how to clean this up. Unfortunately, the new Bush administration seems reluctant to move forward on a nutrient reduction plan that would target factory farms and other sources of nutrient runoff to reduce that waste, basically to recapture it and find some productive use for it rather than to let it go to our coasts and pollute our waters.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We're talking with environmental writer David Helvarg. He has written for many different publications, just to name a few, The Nation, The New York Times, Smithsonian, Audubon, San Francisco Examiner. He's also done work for PBS, and his recent book is all about the oceans, and if you're interested in reading on the subject, you should look for it. It's titled Blue Frontier, Saving America's Living Seas, published by W.H. Freeman and Company. And questions are welcome here. We certainly have time for some others. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Last year, in 2000, there was something passed called the American Oceans Act. And one of the things that was supposed to happen as a result is that there's supposed to be a blue ribbon commission constituted to talk about how it is we manage this resource that we have. Has indeed that commission come to be? Has that yet to be put together? Where do things stand on that?
Well, the law said it was due April 20th, and as of April 20th, the White House is supposed to have a list of 16 commission members. They haven't been released yet because they're still doing background checks on them almost a month later, actually more than a month later now. It's supposed to be named shortly. I saw the initial list that came off of proposed names came off the Hill from the House and Senate, and unfortunately it was 24 names to be selected from there. 24 white men who were mostly overly represented industry, the Navy, the transport industry, commercial fisheries, oil and gas. And I'm hoping, against hope, that the final 16 from that the White House names will be a little more diverse, include some biologists, maybe some outstanding women scientists like Joanne Burkholz or Jane Lubchenco or Sylvia Earle. But we'll have to wait and see. I think the fact of the commission itself and the need to take a new overlook and overview of the state of America's oceans is important. And over the next 18 months, this commission is supposed to hold public hearings throughout coastal America. So no matter what its makeup, I see it as a tremendous opportunity for the public to get engaged and participate and protest if necessary. And if the commission doesn't do the right thing, give them the gaff, because I think ultimately change is going to come from the grassroots, what I call the seaweed rebellion. And I see a lot of that activity beginning to take place in what I talked about before, in coastal restoration of different communities, in certain commercial fishing groups beginning to work with environmentalists and scientists to find ways to do sustainable harvesting, and activist group like the Surf Rider Foundation that are a group of surfers who got tired of going in to catch waves and getting ear infections and gastrointestinal diseases, and so organized and are now an effective voice for ocean protection. And I think that the commission gives us an opportunity to really start to look at things again. The last ocean commission in 1969, the Stratton Commission, even though it failed to get its main proposal for an independent ocean agency for America, like WET NASA, even though we lost that and instead ended up with the Ocean Agency buried in the Department of Commerce. The last commission did give us a Marine Mammal Protection Act and helped generate the Marine Sanctuary System and Coastal Zone Management. And I think that it's clearly that we're in trouble again with our coast. And if we're going to save our blue frontier, we're going to have to look at the big picture. And I think there's an opportunity for that now in this summer and in the next few years to come.
Well, one of the things I know that people in the scientific community in this country are a little concerned about is the lack of interest, seeming lack of interest in the Bush administration in science. The position of White House science advisor is vacant, and in fact, it was something that the administration had talked about just getting rid of completely. There's no, the head scientist position at EPA and at agriculture are vacant. There's no head of the FDA, and they don't seem to be in any great hurry to fill any of those positions.
No, and again, you have an administration that has its priorities set, I think, by their own culture, and their culture is a Texas oil culture. You have a president out of the oil industry, his dad's out of the oil industry, his vice president, his secretary of commerce are all Texas oil guys. And their view of some of these issues are, you know, let's expand our fossil fuel production, whether it's onshore or offshore. On the other hand, the head of the House Science Committee is a moderate Republican who's interested in ocean issues and other environmental issues. And I think the moderate Republicans, the environmentally concerned Northeastern Republicans, just sent a shot across the bow of the administration with Jeffords leaving the Republican Party. I think that their voice and the voice of some Democrats who also have constituencies that are concerned are going to start carrying some weight. I think that, in a sense, it may be a benefit that that the administration is forcing the issues of energy and environment, really making them into one issue, because we have to start looking at how we transition out of fossil fuels, and certainly the greatest impacts from climate change are going to be felt in our coastal cities. I visited the National Hurricane Center and other labs in Florida where the climatologists are literally betting when the big one, the $100 billion city buster, hits our coast. So these are all issues that are going to have to be addressed, and I don't think you can go back into a 19th century attitude of resource exploitation and drill mining and logging as the answer to all things. We can't log the seas, but we can certainly destroy them in a lot of other ways, and it's really up to us. And by us, I mean not just the administration or Washington or a state house. It's up to us individually. 53% of Americans now live in coastal areas, and all Americans are affected by the state of our seas. So we have to get engaged as citizens to make a difference.
We have a couple minutes left here. We do have another caller, someone in Chicago. Let's go there, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask your guest a question. Since water is such a scarce commodity in the world, will desalination of the ocean become a common thing?
It's a good question. I don't know how common it's going to become because the energy costs are still fairly high, but it's certainly in some dry areas like Santa Barbara, California, it's being looked at seriously. I think that it's a likely addition in terms of our fresh water supplies. There's systems in Hawaii, for example, OTEC, where they generate both energy and fresh water by the gradient difference, pumping cold, deep water to the surface. And the pipes actually sweat fresh water, and also the nutrient-rich deep water is used for aquaculture. There's a lot of possibilities. I think desalinization, you also create a lot of brine, a lot of salty water, and you have to figure out what to do with it so you don't overly salinate your local coastal waters. But it's likely desalinization will be part of a solution, but the other part of the solution, of course, is going to be that we not wipe out all our prehistoric aquifers, that we don't build in areas like Las Vegas, try and build cities in deserts, and then begin to wonder why we're having water problems.
All right, thank you.
All right, thanks. I realize we're jumping around a little bit, but going back to the subject of fishing, we talked about how the great growth in aquaculture and the fact that so much of the fish now that we're eating has been farm-raised. We also know that there's been great concern about depletion of wild stocks and places around the country where people historically have fished for a living, and there's been great distress because you have guys who say, hey, my father fished, my grandfather fished, how come I can't? But that seems to be the reality, that is the stocks have been so depleted that there are a lot of places where you just can't do that anymore. What do you think the prospects are for fishing as an industry?
Well, I think commercial fishing, I think, still can exist. Some people, some scientists like Sylvia Earle, think that it's simply we can't do any more hunter-gatherer activities like commercial fishing. I actually get a little prescriptive in my book. I have what I call blue plate special. There's so many acronyms in fisheries. My blue is for buybacks. We're overcapitalized. The fleet has to be shrunk in size. Limited entry. That is, you can't allow more fishing power into an area than the local fishery can sustain. We need underwater reserves. The scientists are talking about 20% of the seas being essentially no-take areas, fish breeding and reproduction areas, to bring back some of the historic bounty. And we need an end to the conflict of interest. Our fisheries management today is run by 8 regional councils where Jesse James gets to sit on the Railroad Commission. They're the only federal regulatory agencies exempted from conflict of interest, and you can't have... I've talked to fishermen who said it's not my job to determine the fish catch. My job is to put food on the table for my family. And, you know, I think that if we did that, the buybacks, limited entry, underwater reserves, so what they call marine protected areas, and we got rid of the politics in the fishery management, that it would still be possible to do sustainable fishery and that we're still doing some limited attempts at sustainable fishery on the West Coast and parts of Alaska. We may have to reduce, it's almost un-American to say less technology, but in fact, we've got the technological ability to wipe out our fisheries in a year. What we need to do is find less technologically advanced ways that are maybe more labor intensive that allow fishing communities and community-based fishermen and women to still earn a living in a way that that doesn't take out the resource they depend on.
There, we're going to have to stop because we've used our time. I want to say to you, Mr. Helvarg, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. And as I say, it's endless and interesting topic and also a great place to surf.
Well, and if people want to read more, they should look for the book we've mentioned. It's titled Blue Frontier, Saving America's Living Seas by our guest, journalist, environmental writer, David Helvarg.